This is James Evan Pawato from Media Monarchy, and you're listening to Sync Book Radio from thesyncbook.com.
Time at a big coincidence.
There's the holy moment, and then there's the awareness of trying to have the holy moment. In the same way as the film is the actual moment really happening, but then the character pretending to be in a different reality. And it's all these layers.
We think everything is separate, limited. I'm over here, you're over there, which is true, but it's not the whole truth, because we're all connected.
The time as of now is now. And you are listening to Synchronize, the weekly audio magazine exploring and highlighting the best in the synchronistic arts. Please set your minds to open.
Open the floodgate doors.
Hello, and welcome to Synchronize. My name is Alan Abadesa Green. We have a great episode for you today. Rae Dawn Chong joins us to talk about her films, her time with the Rolling Stones, and her latest project, an Indiegogo campaign called The Celebrant. Things get really interesting when Rae Dawn plays Radio 8 Ball, and then Ezra Sanzerbell brings in his special touch of synchro musicology to dig even deeper. All this and more coming up, but first I want to talk to you about something. Starting off a new show for Syncbook Radio and building it from the ground up, I thought this was an excellent opportunity to give some sort of foundation for new listeners, a starting place for those coming to the material for the first time. One of the things we do quite often within this community is play with media and experiment with different reality tunnels. This allows us to view media through different lenses and find out what the viewer brings to the table. Though we talk about sharing dreams and synchronicity, it is often very difficult to do so because of the personal nature of both. So we often rely on media as something we can share. Film, music, books, they're almost a form of repeatable synchronicity. Of course, only the media itself is static, so even this comes with a huge variable. As Bruce Willis says in 12 Monkeys, "The movie never changes, it can't change, but every time you see it, it seems different because you're different, you see different things." For us, that's actually ideal. We want to see different things. While shifting context and perceptions, set and setting, make it impossible to truly repeat the same experience, we're left with the variable of most interest to our study, the human psyche and individual forms of perception. This is why the study of sync often reflects back to us revelations of self through what we think of as the external world. I should note that there are many who do not take kindly to using media, particularly pop culture, as a gauge of synchronicity. Media's artificial nature brings with it a number of criticisms and some valid concerns, but I believe they are addressed by the kaleidoscopic approach I am suggesting. Previously, I have used the metaphor of peeling the layers of an onion, and others have used the imagery of levels on an elevator, but I've found that most people take that to imply a sort of hierarchy, as if the deeper one goes, the closer it is to the quote-unquote truth, or that it is more correct. Something that I have really held to in this community is the idea that all of these perspectives are in some way valid, and that there is a time and a place for each one. This is an area that Andras and I very much agree on. He wrote a chapter in his book called The Balanced Diet of Cults. For me, it is a similar sort of thing. It is a balanced palette of perspectives. Along the same lines, there are no rules. This is a community and an art movement without dogma. We're more often breaking away from structure rather than adding to it. However, I wanted to give our listeners a brief walkthrough of how such a thing might be structured, if it ever were to be, at least for the sake of explanation. So, if you're ready to try out some new perspectives, I'm going to show how one might begin to break media down. For this purpose, I thought that we should start with a piece of media that everyone has seen, something where we'd all have a common context. Looking for the most universal media that everyone would be familiar with, we decided on Star Wars. Let's start with the surface narrative. This should be pretty self-explanatory. From a surface narrative point of view, Star Wars is just about a kid with robot friends who gets superpowers, kisses his sister, and kills his dad while saving the universe from an evil empire. While it requires very little effort to dig deeper, there is still a time and a place for this kind of perspective. Sometimes a rose is just a rose, and a cigar is just a cigar. Now we move into art imitating life, or at least other art, under a heading we'll call intentional symbolism. Since there are so many people on the internet these days pointing to the symbolism used in media as evidence of a conspiracy, we'll hit this node first. Paranoid awareness has its value at times, in that it has been said that all art is propaganda.
It's a trap!
Ultimately, this is an aspect of our survival instinct, as it is an attempt to protect oneself from danger. It is good to a point, but too much focus on this area, or only focusing on this layer, leads to unhealthy paranoia. People coming from this perspective have claimed that, rather than being a cautionary tale, Star Wars Episode 1 is a blueprint for global enslavement, a sort of how-to turn a republic into an empire. We should note that similar accusations have been leveled against the funding of various George Orwell projects by the CIA, and the list goes on. For a non-conspiratorial perspective, it is a little different. Remember all that stuff your high school teacher wanted you to focus on when assigned to read a book for class? You were asked to recognize some basic symbolism and scope out the metaphors to get what the author was really trying to say. Though you probably never thought so at the time, this is an excellent skill to develop. For our study, we go way beyond the basics, and it is here where a rich symbolic, mythological, and esoteric vocabulary will take you far. As most of you know, Joseph Campbell and his hero's journey was a huge influence on Star Wars, impacting everything from the structure of the myth arcs to the plot itself. Here, there's a mythological level to be sure. There's also influence from real-life sources, such as the medal ceremony at the end of Episode 4 being directly based on footage from the Nazi propaganda film Triumph of the Will. Now, especially when paired with the prequels and the fact that they were made later, effectively showing the Empire's rise after showing the Empire's fall, all this ties into the idea of a cyclical nature to things, as well as the danger of the Rebel Alliance, or any of us, becoming the very things we fight against, the very things we hate.
Don't give in to hate. That leads to the dark side.
Everything we've mentioned so far you might find in a basic intro to film criticism, but now we'll start to get progressively more esoteric. An obi is a Japanese belt used on kimonos, and the character of Obi-Wan is very much inspired by Japanese samurai films. Along similar lines, super attentive fans have noticed that in Star Wars Episodes 5 and 6, the chest panel of Darth Vader's armor has Hebrew lettering that can be translated as, "His deeds will not be forgiven until he merits." This Hebrew letter detail may also give us some hint at Yoda's name, since the Hebrew letter Yod is the smallest and most foundational of the letters. It is also the first letter in the Tetragrammaton, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. While Joseph Campbell's monomyth has been used intentionally as a model very often, the concept arises in the first place due to its all-pervasive nature. Since Star Wars borrows from so many sources, trying to distinguish where intentional symbolism stops and unintentional symbolism starts could be debated. For the sake of this example, pretend we're turning that page now. Let us consider what follows as unintentional symbolism, or life imitating art. The 78 cards of the Tarot, and particularly the 22 trump cards, represent a catalog of archetypes that are expressed over and over again in nearly everything. I think of it very much like the periodic table of elements. The main characters of a Star Wars can be easily transposed into this system. Jason Brera touched on some of this in his chapter for the Sync Book Volume 1. And truth be told, as I started to think of this list, I found it so much fun that it was hard to keep this brief. The first trump of the Tarot is called the Fool, and it is his journey that we follow through the tarot sequence. On the card, he is depicted holding a staff of light and walking off a ledge into the sky. Luke Skywalker is, of course, a Skywalker. He's also immature and a bit goofy when we first meet him, and he goes on to get a very literal staff of light. The next card is the Magician, which we can see as Obi-Wan and his Jedi magic. Up next is the High Priestess, who hides a secret scroll in her gown. This is Princess Leia, who hides the blueprints of the Death Star. We'll do just a few more. The fourth card is called the Emperor, and the fifth card is the Pope. Emperor Palpatine serves double duty in his role as both the literal Emperor and a sort of Pope as Lord of the Sith. Han Solo, the solo loner, would be the Hermit. The card now known as Strength was previously called La Force, and may it be with you. The 13th card is called Death, and the 17th card is the Star, giving us the Death Star. Even though I'd actually probably place that as the Tower, but we'll save that conversation for another time and move on from the Tarot. For further mythological connections, we can think of the Millennium Falcon as evoking the Aeon of Horus, just as the frequent themes of dismemberment in Star Wars relates to Osiris. Now, even if some of the previous examples were intentional, we start to get into areas of synchronicity and non-linear time with composite characters, as they are the first step outside of the world of the single piece of media. Seeing how the media connects to other pieces of media is our first taste of true interconnectivity. An easy example might be Harrison Ford interacting with droids in Star Wars and replicants in Blade Runner. But it gets better. We saw that Mark Hamill played the Fool as Luke Skywalker, but he also voiced the Joker, a dark version of the Fool archetype, in the Batman animated series. Darth Vader was a Jedi Knight who went over to the dark side, making him a Dark Knight, just like Batman. Mark Hamill as Joker kills Dark Knight Batman's parents, another flip on this interplay. This almost interchangeable nature of Luke and Vader, as well as the Joker and Batman, is cosmically hinted at or foreshadowed by the image of Luke's face in Vader's helmet in Episode 5. Now, let's go outside of media and into synchronicities with real life. For example, consider Mark Hamill's car accident and facial scarring as tied into the Star Wars dismemberment themes, and even more explicitly as tied into the Joker's facial disfigurement. Then there's Ronald Reagan's Star Wars initiative, and Reagan certainly helped shovel some dirt on the corpse of the US Republic. The character of Luke Skywalker was given a name based on that of his creator, Lucas, who recently went over to the dark side and sold all of the Star Wars rights to Disney. Here again we have a triumph of another evil empire. The next zoom out would take us outside of the media as well as the events of the world stage. It is here where we would look at how the media plays into our personal synchronicities. I'm going to leave this description open-ended, however, since that's for you to fill in.
Use the Force, Luke. Let go, Luke.
The Force is strong in this one.
This is Joe Alexander from Barely Human on YouTube, and you're listening to Sync Book Radio from thesyncbook.com.
Up next, I interview Raydon Chong. Raydon Chong is best known as an actor in films like Quest for Fire, The Color Purple, Soul Man, Jeff Who Lives at Home, and Alan Rudolph's Choose Me. Raydon is also a writer, producer, and a woman of profound insight. She is currently developing an independent TV production called The Celebrant that we'll be discussing today. You can support this project by visiting her Indiegogo page, linked up in the show notes, at thesyncbook.com/synchronize. As of this recording, there's about a week left to support her campaign, so please be sure to donate while you still can. Raydon was also featured in a Jay Kotze film called Phoenix Dawn. This talk was recorded on May 3rd, 2013. Raydon, welcome to Synchronize. It's an honor to speak with you today.
Thank you.
I wanted to start this off with a question you probably don't get all that often. I'm fascinated by your role in the Mick Jagger video, Just Another Night, particularly that your name is Dawn and this plays on the theme of day and night. I'd like to ask what the experience of working on that video was like, and if you have any insight, maybe you can tell me what the hell is going on in it.
Well, first of all, I don't know what's going on because I never knew what was going on and neither did they. We just were taken to Brazil and I ran into Mick Jagger and Keith Richards in a restaurant in New York City about 4 months before I was called to go to Brazil with Mick to do this. And they were shooting this Rolling Stones video with Angelina Jolie. And I said to them, and they had just come back from a shoot, and they were coming into this hotel for a drink. And I ran into them, and I'd known them a long time. My friend Mackenzie Phillips, John Phillips from the Mamas and the Papas, I had met Mick Jagger when I was 17, so at this point I was 24. So I said to them, wait a second, you're doing a video without me? I'm not in a video. And when I said, put me in a video, and I said this directly to Mick Jagger. So then, like, 2 months later, or maybe even less than that, I got a phone call from Alvinia, who was his assistant, and she said, listen, they're doing a movie down in Brazil for Mick's solo record, and he wants to star as the lead. Do you want to do it? And I said, yeah. And they said, it's going to be a month. And I said, is there a script? They said, no, we're going to basically just sort of listen to the songs and figure out what to do. There's no script. I mean, there's a couple ideas on a napkin. Do you want a copy of that? And I was like, no, I'm all set. That's fine. And then they brought myself, Dennis Hopper, and Jerry Hall was also with us. And we went down to Rio. And it was at a time when Rio had a big problem with homeless children. I mean, as young as, like, toddlers. It was pretty rough, but it was kind of exciting. So we went down there, and the thing about the script and the story, I played girls in my moniker, which was kind of irritating, but the idea was that I was a karaoke. I was like a street chick, and he was Mick Jagger, kind of on the run and in trouble, and that's why it's called Running Out of Luck. And that was the concept that I went down there on, and it, you know, it turned out okay. I mean, he looked really amazing. I knew the Stones as people, like I'd known them for a long time as guys, but I never went to any of their concerts, and I still do. Historically, I've never been to a Stones concert. So when I sat down, I've sung with Mick Jagger and been in sessions with him and hung out with him. And when I was, you know, younger, we were like, you know, he was like one of my early lovers. But when we did this movie, this man, I couldn't believe how good he was. It was really kind of embarrassing. Like, here I had this private performance of Mick Jagger jumping about, and it was like, oh my God, he's really good. So that's crazy and still my life been, because in a way, I don't know. Look, it's just, I don't know if I answered your question, but that's how that all went down.
Oh, absolutely. No, that's very interesting. And I assume that in that song where he's mentioning the night, obviously, and there are lines where he refers to the dawn, that was unintentional use of your name or your role there.
Yeah, I don't think he wrote that song with me in mind, but, you know, it is about light. Turns out I might be a carrier of light.
Oh, I think so. Yeah. I think so. We're going to get into that. I definitely think so. That's a nice... I know you're working now on a project called The Celebrant, which I think deals a lot with this light. Can you tell us about The Celebrant?
Yep. You know, I sat down a couple years ago and decided if I pick what would I as an actor and as a woman want to portray every week? What would be a character that would be interesting to me and feeds my soul? And I started thinking about who witnessed the big moment in strangers' lives. Like, how could I be in touch with everyday people and not be a cop and not be a hospital worker? But can I go even deeper than those two relationships? Can I even go into a place where we're asking the big God questions? Because I think with times being so tough that we do have existential questions. And with a lot of intolerance globally with religion, I thought, well, it's kind of a wonderful with the celebrant here in the seacoast for me to be a witness without being quote-unquote Christian religious, to talk about spirituality and to watch people go through things like weddings and the walk up to a lifelong commitment, and then having people say, I want a Buddhist wedding, or I want a Christian wedding, or I want a Muslim wedding, and being the person that can actually facilitate that ritual. And a celebrant is a person who goes through teaching and becomes certified and can do that. And it's not representing any particular dogma or religion. And I thought that was a wonderful way to be a conduit to the whole experience of spirituality in a person's individual private moment. And the good news about being a celebrant is I get to witness when people go through and be together with them when they go through transitions like death, or when they go through a transition like birth and then the like. And then as an artist and as a writer, I get to write around, I get to create a world in New England. And New England is like, I don't know, where I live reminds me a little bit of the Cotswolds, or it's like a very rural, but very filled with a lot of culture and a lot of history. So there's a lot of crazy, wonderful characters, and I get to bring them and introduce them to the world of television. So it's a great role. I feel so lucky that I sat down and wrote it, and that it came out as well as it's come out, and I'm willing to, you know, do all the work which crowdfunding does, but it is a lot of work, but, and bring it to the world. And so I'm really thrilled about that. And it's nice. I think it's time to have a show on television that stars somebody who's, you know, ethnic and of age, and it talks about the big God questions. I like that.
Oh, absolutely. Even in your Indiegogo promo video, you mentioned the idea of a need to express concepts that are not necessarily religious, but certainly spiritual. And do you think the time is right, or there's a potential for the crossover between spirituality and media?
I think it is. We are desperate for a bridging. I think we are desperate for something that's not just stuck to the usual, whether it's Catholicism, Christianity, evangelicals. I mean, we're getting, like, pummeled by a particularly, I mean, not to judge it, but I'm going to say something, but it seems a little intolerant, the whole thing of it, unless you take Jesus as your Savior, you're not really spiritual. And I find that fascinating, because I've been to a couple Pentecostal revival things, and I've had a lot of people who are happen to be Christian who said to me, you are not a believer if you don't take Jesus as your Savior. And my response to that is, but I do take Jesus as my Savior, and I do take Muhammad as being Muhammad and as close to God. And I do take, you know, Yahweh, and I do take, you know, Buddha. I mean, I say yes to it all, because aren't we, I mean, how could you say no to any of it, you know? And I find that people may get upset because it's like not picking a team, but I think we're ripe and ready to say, look, is spirituality only from one conduit? Is there only one way? No. And if you don't go to church, if you don't practice a particular practice, does that make you any less connected to the divine? No. So I think our show, I mean, my intention of my show is to show that, you know, from the mouths of babes, from the animal kingdom, from the simplest things in life, is the profundity of the big divine.
Oh, yeah. When we do these sync videos or our sync analysis of media, we often do this where we're combining elements from each different religion or each different mythology from around the world. I think this is important and something that media allows us to do. Considering that media allows us to bend spirituality or combine spirituality and media, and that we see that what we're able to delve into other mythologies, what was it like to watch Jay Katz's film about your sync thread that's woven through your acting career?
It made me cry. I was so struck by it, because we're absolutely clueless. You're talking about something that, I mean, it's a big through line, and to have an outsider look at your whole creative output and then sort of cycle it back to your very essence and being. And, you know, we don't give in society enough credence to the names we get, and that my name is Ray Dawn. And it really kind of made me feel incredibly, I felt like my life was, there's a reason to it. There was some, he sort of connected me to my Dharma, that the Dharma being why I'm here. I'm here to bring light. And I loved that. And, you know, everybody is here to bring light, and everybody has a Dharma. Everyone has some kind of groovy, beautiful contribution to the universe, without sounding completely woo-woo. But when I saw what he did with my name, and that it's about light, it just helped me tremendously as a woman, as an actor, and as someone to look back and go, oh, that's cool. So thank you, Mr. Jake. I loved it.
Yeah, Jake's an amazing filmmaker.
Super good.
I apologize in advance, but this next question is a long one, as it needs a good deal of context. So just bear with me one moment. One of the subjects we are discussing in this episode is the difference between intentional and unintentional use of symbolism. Two nights ago, I rewatched the video Jake made for you. Then I watched your appearance on Radio 8 Ball, which the listener can watch if they follow the links in the show notes for this podcast. Directly after, I watched the 15-minute teaser for The Celebrant. I noted a very strong symbolic through line cutting across all three. Jake's video focuses on your sync attraction to themes of fire, the flaming furnace, the sunrise, death and rebirth, and the phoenix. Then you ask a Radio 8 Ball question about hardship, and the answer song was called Skeletons. You all note the correlation to death and rebirth, but then you make a reference to the Olympics happening at the time and give a specific example, of the Olympic athlete Apollo Ono's hardships. I'm not even sure if you realize that you were bringing up an Olympian named Apollo, and the mythological Apollo was the Olympic god of the sun, which we know you resonate with. The Radio 8 Ball segment then ends with Andras mentioning that this is the first time that an actor or actress is watching a Sync video made about them, that this is a historical moment where the Sync filmmakers and the actors are engaging one another. He then wonders what the impact will be on Jake's films and your career. Well, in the new Celebrant teaser, the story is all about euthanasia and dealing with death, and it ends with you having a conversation about death and rebirth while sitting in front of a furnace while smoke billows over you and your red jacket. It would seem that the Phoenix theme is still running very strong with you. I want to know if any of this was intentional, or if not, what do you make of this undeniable attraction?
Well, yeah, there you go. It's so wild. I know it was not conscious. It's no conscious intention whatsoever. We're talking all subliminal, all subconscious. It's absolutely, obviously up. Because it's funny, the scene, the Celebrant opens with the scene with this particular client, person Margaret, passing, and my facilitating it. And it is illegal, by the way, that I help her do this in New Hampshire. It's not allowed. But then I talk to Frank. And by the way, Frank is a ghost. He's not a real, he's not in three dimensions. He's actually a figment of my imagination. So that's even more, you know, fiery. I don't know. It's my theme, I guess, because the script goes into these. I have three clients and three people that I take care of in the pilot in the 55 minutes. And interesting that it is. There's a death theme for sure, and that will probably be throughout the whole series. There is always that thing of coming through hardship, through it. And also, she's on a self-imposed witness protection program because she's escaping a really violent marriage. And so that will definitely be a theme. I didn't even know. And to me, I always feel like my feet are being held to the flame, metaphorically, you know, just in terms of who I am as a person and as a woman who struggles with everyday stuff, you know, whether it's, you know, something as simple as creating prosperity, or whether it's something as simple as dealing with my imperfections, I feel that. So, no, I it's unconscious. Isn't that funny? I never consciously do it.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. I love stories like that.
It shows how that we're resonators, because it must be the tune of my soul. Does that make sense? It must be the tuning of my soul. I mean, some people are just airier, lighter, and life is a lot easier. Not me, not so much. Not so much.
Yeah, you definitely have a fire thing going for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we saw what happened the last time you engaged Radio 8 Ball. Are you ready to do it again?
Sure, yes, please.
Absolutely. Then let's welcome the host of Radio 8 Ball, another fiery persona, Andras Jones.
This is Ralph Metzner, and you're listening to the Radio 8 Ball with Andras Jones.
Hi, Ray Don.
Hi.
Welcome to this synchronized segment of Radio 8 Ball, the show where we answer questions by picking songs at random and interpreting those randomly chosen songs as the answers to the questions. You're a veteran of many Radio 8 Balls on the radio, in Olympia, in Seattle, as a part of our live show. So you know how it works, and I bet you have a great question for the Pop Oracle.
I just want to say, is it okay not to know? My question is it all right not to know?
Is it all right not to know? That's a great question. Well, what we're going to be using as our Oracle fodder today, in honor of your appearance in the Just Another Night video, and now we find out your long personal history with the Rolling Stones, we're going to be using the full discography of the Rolling Stones as our Oracle fodder to pick the answer to your question. So I'm going to push shuffle function right now, and we'll see what we get.
Wow.
that was the Rolling Stones from their 1980 CD album, Tattoo You, and the song Slave, track number 3. The answer to Ray Don Chong's question, is it okay not to know?
That's heavy, especially because it's called Slave. Oh boy, where do we start? I don't want to be your slave. Well, I know, it's complicated. For one thing, I played Slave Girl in his movie, so that's kind of creepy and weird, because that was my name, according to the script and the liner notes of that film. That's weird.
Wait, you're saying your character was named Slave Girl?
Which is weird. And then the fact is, don't want to be your slave, not to know could be maybe not knowing something or not... is to not maybe one not want to be not wanting to be slave to the outcome. You don't want to be a slave to an outcome because you're so worried about how it's going to turn out that it entraps you, it enslaves you. So that's one thing that comes to me. The other thing is if you don't know or if you are in ignorance, it could make you a slave to the moment, a slave to the issue. So like the, you know what I mean, on both sides of it, it comes up for me both sides. Like to know, to be really. To be really invested in knowing something can create a type of slavedom, and then to also not know something and to be ignorant and in the dark can also create a vulnerability or a slave response. So it's quite complicated.
Oh yeah, I think so
too. And it's a sexy groove. I was very much complimenting the fact that the groove is awesome. It's a great song.
Well, I was noticing that too, and as a sort of a student of rock history and a fan of a wide variety of music and the Stones and sort of tracking their influences, the opening is really, really very much like the opening of a Little Feat song. And I know that the Stones were aware of Little Feat, and this would have been recorded after Little Feat were doing their thing. So there's something about the Stones. This is one of the things that's taken me a while to learn and to appreciate about the Stones. When I was a kid, I just kind of thought they were jerks. They were kind of evil. I was a Beatles fan and I didn't really enjoy that. But as I've gotten older, I actually have grown to appreciate the sort of, I don't know, I guess that sort of evil quality, and I'm putting quotes around that because I don't think they're actually evil, but there's a way...
They're not evil at all.
No, but at the same time, there's something about, you know, the way they engage racial politics, the way that they just are a band and gleefully rip off people and know that they can, like, when the Stones rip off something, they kind of own it because they're bigger than anybody. And...
Yeah.
So there's something like, is it okay not to know? There's something about, I have to imagine that the key to being able to play with all this dark stuff and to not have it be evil is some level of ignorance, whether it's willful or not, that allows you to be innocent. To innocently steal or to innocently play with ideas that other people are afraid of.
Well, wait a second. For someone who knows Keith Richards well enough to, I can say this about him. He knows, like, literally knows how to play 1,000 songs, if not 10,000 songs. He only plays music all day. Like, that's what Keith, he's like a musical savant. That's all he does when you see him every day. When you hang out with him, there's always a guitar. He's always making music. Same with Mick Jagger, but a lot more with Keith Richards. And he is such an encyclopedia of every kind of form, song, record ever recorded by anybody that had any good going. So I would say the way they bite off of people or copy people is really a huge compliment. So you see, it's all perspective, right? If you, from their perspective, when you sit with them, and you listen to what their musicology and their ethnomusicology, they know, he knows so much about music and, you know, the most obscure people he just appreciates and loves. So if he's stealing from someone's style, it's a total homage. It's a real love gesture. I think people have always equated the Stones with such a dark thing because they've been so hedonistic. You know, they've had so much love, so much sex,
so much drugs and they've gone full bore into it. But if you know them and you hang around them and you've had any time with them, they're really just lads who were lucky and, you know, they like to live well. And you can't, there's not, it's not really sinister per se. I mean, they don't, you know, they never really prostituted women. They never hurt you. Like, I was a kid around them, so I can vouch that I was much safer probably with Keith Richards because he treated me like he was like an uncle, but unlike Mick Jagger, he's not. But that I was not that safe with Mick Jagger, but as guys, they were actually not really that dark. Whereas if you really hear about a lot of stuff with the Beatles, they were pretty dark.
Yeah,
you know,
no, I think that's one of the very interesting paradoxes in rock and roll.
Yeah, because their music is very la-di-da-di-da and very classically based, the Beatles, and incredible, obviously, the best ever. But then if you listen to the Stones, because they've done, I think, you know, interesting because it seems so right as we're talking about fire and hardship, and the Stones are all about, you know, getting burned and getting and going through the hard, they're going doing the hard route. And, you know, if you're a black person, a person of color, and if you're a woman, life is fucking hard. You don't get paid. You're working at a deficit. A woman gets paid 60 cents in America, a black woman. A woman who's not black, who's white, gets paid 77 cents to the dollar. But a black woman gets 60 cents to the dollar. And a black man, maybe even less. So it's so hardcore. And so these guys really, really admire and wanted to emulate everything to do with sort of black America in a way. I mean, Jagger, you know, has kids from women of color. He loves women of color. Same with even Keith Richards, although, you know, Keith Richards, I would say, as far as wanting to be a person of color, I would say musically, yes. You know what I mean? I think Keith Richards wanted to be Chuck Berry, and he even told me once that he, at one point in his life, he admired Chuck Berry so much. So isn't that funny? And so we equate the devil with them because they're willing to go to the dark side. But in some ways, I would argue that those guys are really, like, in some ways, have a clearer or even almost a cleaner essence. Isn't that funny?
Yeah, I think that in terms of the answer to your question, you get a similar paradox where is it okay not to know? And it's sort of like actually in not knowing, there is a kind of deeper knowing in being willing.
Maybe.
What's that?
Maybe there's a protection too, you know?
Yeah.
Because for instance, even doing the celebrant on Indiegogo and doing this crowdfunding, I don't know. I didn't know how hard it was. I think if I knew, I wouldn't have done it. And when I mean hard, I mean, you have so much work you have to do. You have to hustle. I'm literally, you know, contacting thousands of people and just getting my reach, making it broader. It's a lot. It's worth it, and I'm totally digging it. But you've got to be on the computer and on the computer, and, you know, you've got to really be hustling, and you've got to run around and meet people and hand them cards and say, you know, here's my campaign. It's intense, dude. It's intense. I'm learning a lot, and I'm also kind of going, whoa, I'm glad I didn't know, because I don't know that I would have done it. I would have been, like, too wimpy.
That's the power in, you know, in not knowing, is you get out there and you do it. And I really hope, that your appearance on this, I hope that people who are listening to this really, that they go to your Indiegogo campaign for the celebrant and that they support it with their money. And also, I'm learning with doing these Indiegogo campaigns, also just being willing to spread the word, finding, you know, connecting it to your people, being excited enough about that. So I really encourage everyone.
Oh my gosh, if people just put my link on their Facebook page for a couple of days, it just reaches 1,000 more people or 100
right.
more people. And then other people keep doing it. It's viral. And for all you souls out there, if you do, you don't, you know, if you're in a position where you can't necessarily exchange energy, which is money, please exchange your online world with me, because it is as important, if not more, that you just spread the word. And I just want to tell you, I love you for that, because this is how we're going to roll from here on out. It's spreading the word.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. So thank you.
Thank you.
For talking to me and helping me get my message out. And thank you to the Sync guys for showing me a little bit about what I'm emanating and what my glow is, you know. it's so neat to hear this. It's so neat to see someone take, you know, different aspects of my life and say, hey, did you know that this is what you're putting out there? It's cool.
Well, just so you know, it works the both ways, because just as your artwork sort of shows your unconscious or subconscious resonance, even though I'm someone who's very familiar with synchronicity and is doing this of looking at things, my own subconscious often comes out. And I feel like your Radio 8 Ball answer was actually something, and a sort of subconscious or unconscious expression of a question that I wanted to ask you but decided not to. So this is interesting. What I was going to do was, I wanted to ask a question, but I thought since this is talking about the celebrant, I wanted to focus on that and kind of keep this a nice, friendly conversation. But there was this question in the back of my mind that was kind of nagging at me. And even before I came on this call, I spoke to a friend of mine and told him I was about to do this interview. And he mentioned the movie Soul Man. And he said, that is such a racist movie. And I said, yeah, I said, I've always sort of struggled with that. Is it a racist? It sort of has this turn where it's like, oh, shucks, that was a bad way to behave. And yet it seems to really draw a very thin line between what, you know, racism as humor. And it's sort of an interesting little struggle there of whether or not it's racist or somehow anti-racism, or, you know, trying to promote the idea of tolerance. And I wanted to know what you think of that.
I have to tell you something. It's so interesting you would say that. I think at the time when we made the movie, the one thing I really focused on and I thought that we absolutely achieved was great humor, because it was really, really funny to see this white guy trying to be a black man because of the Harvard scholarship, and it was a good dilemma. But, you know, but then to have like the long tail expression of, is this a racist movie? Is this a negative? You know, yeah, I can see where it's really racist, because like even The Help, my mother-in-law, when we went to see The Help, I said, have you seen it? It's quite a good movie, but, you know, the book, I thought the book was better, but whatever. But my mother-in-law said, I'm not going to see it. I think it's the most racist thing. And she felt the same way about The Blind Side. She said, it's always white people helping black people, and it's just so racist. And I stepped back and went, oh, my God, I see that. Now, The Blind Side is a very good movie, and it's a really wonderful story. But again, my mother-in-law's point of view is valid as well, which is, it's another white person helping a black person, and that's so racist. So in going to cycle back to The Soul Man, it's another, what's racist about it is that in order to get a really good, to get a really good scholarship, you know, do you have to be black? And if you're, you know, and to get into Harvard, if you're a rich white kid who loses the opportunity, does he have to be black to get into it? So yeah, that is a racist thing. It's racist on so many levels. Is it racist? Yes, it's racist. It's racism on so many levels. Yeah. And then let's get further with it. If you're a person of color in America, and you know, is it racist to comment on the fact that it's never been a level playing field? Is that racist? Isn't that black racism against white people? Because just recently I wrote a blog and spoke about the fact that there's no women of color on television that are in leads. There's no black women, not even just black, Asian, Spanish, whatever. There's no ethnic women as leads, protagonists in television series. There's only, right now we have Kerry Washington in Scandal. She's the first one in over 25 years. So that's ridiculous. Is it racist to bring that up? See, isn't it funny, Andres? Yes, Soul Man's racist, but it's racist on like 16 different levels. But then so is The Help. So is The Blind Side. So is America. It's like, right. It's all about racism.
This is a conversation that Alan and I have a lot, which is just about, because when you're dealing with synchronicity, you're dealing with reality and with real, like what I consider to be real psychology. Like, you can't fake a person's sync. And the sync reveals everything about everything, and the more you focus on it. And so the question isn't, you know, are we sexist, or are we racist, or are we homophobic, or are we classist? you know, or are we anti-Semitic? We're all, you know, we.
Yes. Just say
the
yes.
Question is,
you
the
are.
The question is not are we, but how are we? You know.
Yes, that's right. You're right.
You know.
Do we self-segregate? Are we segregators? Yes. Are we racist? Yes.
Yeah, we're swimming in a soup of, you know, we're still. Psychologically, we're still swimming in the 19th century and the 20th century's karma. And so.
And by the way, and can I tell you, part of it is laziness. Part of it is, like, for instance, you know, it really breaks my heart when I hear on the news shows that Congress won't help Obama. Because not because it's good policy, not because it would completely take care of America, get us out of this lump or whatever we're in, you know, not because it would help people in the middle class and it would feed children and get them in Head Start. No, they're not helping him because he's the black guy in the White House. They're not helping him because he's Obama. And that is so sad. It's like you go, well, your job as a person in Congress, isn't it to help facilitate and make America better? Oh, no. Apparently that's not true. It's like I go, God, we are like not as evolved as we'd like to fancy ourselves.
And these are the These are the topics that we don't really, no one likes to really approach, because I think there's often this racist taboo that's used to other people's advantage as well, because. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, I see very little difference between Barack Obama and George Bush. And whereas George Bush, the people who didn't like him just got to say, oh, that man's stupid, which I actually don't think he was that stupid. I think he served his role very well of, you know, spreading war around the world and things like that. And Obama has very much continued that policy of starting wars. He's invaded more countries than George Bush has. He's more corporate friendly than even George Bush was. And yet you can't really have that conversation because the level of debate gets reduced down to that it's a race issue for on one side or the other, and I think that's very, very sad.
You're so right about that. Obama is flawed. We do have the drone program, and it's the most. We do still have a Guantanamo. We do still have the fact that he's a badass. He will go in, and he is no different than George Bush in a lot of the stuff that's going on. But the question is, too, you know, is it not only just, is it the office of president? Like, what exactly... what we, the public, don't know about that particular job and about what we're dealing with. I don't know. You know, it's like I'm really appreciating the fact that we're not jumping into Syria, but I am really gutted that we have Guantanamo. I think it's disgusting that these men have not gotten a trial, let alone they're being held in boxes. I mean, this is just, to me, so sad. So you're right. He's no better than George Bush. Until he closes Guantanamo, he's no better than George Bush for me.
This is where your Radio 8 Ball answer serves me well, because when you said we don't know what it's like to be in that role, and I often struggle with this, and I think it's okay not to know, but I also know I don't want to be anyone's slave. So
yeah.
That I think we can all agree on.
We would like to thank Raydon Chung for joining us on Synchronize. Remember, her Indiegogo campaign for the celebrant ends on Tuesday, May 14th, so be sure to check it out now.
This is Douglas Bowles from 42 Minutes, and you're listening to Synchronize with Andras Jones and Alan Green, a production of Sync Book Radio from thesyncbook.com.
Oh, I see what you're
all right,
doing.
Take two. Here we go.
Really?
I have to do a couple of these. I feel like a D-I-C-K for not... I mean, it was a couple of weeks ago that he asked for these from us, Will.
I sent one in.
No so way.
I did now. I care if it like a couple of times.
All right.
Joe's was badass.
Yeah,
though.
It was. This is what I'm like, the standard. This is Douglas Bowles, the Goblin King of Winter's Labyrinth, and you're listening to Synchronize, a production of Sync Book Radio from thesyncbook.com.
And now we are lucky enough to have a contribution from Ezra Sanzerbell, the man behind the Tone Color Alchemy Project and the study of what he calls synchromusicology. Ezra has collaborated with Radio 8 Ball a number of times in a number of ways, and he also contributed a chapter to the Sync Book Volume 2. He is now working with longtime friend and collaborator Steve Wilner from Labyrinth of the Psychonaut on something we're eager to tell you about. Details of that project will be revealed in the next few weeks right here on Synchronize. For more of Ezra's work, please visit tonecoloralchemy.com.
Today we're going to be contemplating a chain of musical synchronicities through the looking glass of Rae Dawn Chong and her appearance in Mick Jagger's 1985 music video for Just Another Night. As Jay Kotze pointed out a few years ago in his Phoenix Dawn video, Rae Dawn's first and middle name invoke two concepts that share a common root in sun symbolism. The Egyptian sun god Amun-Re was said to rise in the noon sky, die at night, and find rebirth in the dawn of morning. Julie Andrews affirms this in The Sound of Music when she sings Do a deer, a female deer, Re, a drop of golden sun. The equivalence between the name Re and golden sun brings us to our next connection, a late 19th century magical order out of Britain called the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. An initiatory secret society designed to advance spiritual development through transformative ritual practice, the Golden Dawn devised a system of correspondence that formed an unchanging core of alchemical formula. The correspondence table included a tone color system that linked the 12 chromatic musical notes with the 12 colors of the color wheel. These 12 tone colors were in turn attributed to the 22 cards of the tarot's major arcana. Here's where things get a bit strange. The song from Rae Dawn and Mick Jagger's Just Another Night video was recorded in the musical key of B-flat minor. In the Golden Dawn's tone color system, B-flat corresponds to the color purple and two tarot cards, the Wheel of Fortune and the Star. That same year, Mick Jagger was photographed for a promotional poster for Just Another Night, which showed him laying on a bed next to a television. On the TV set was a large image of the Wheel of Fortune. Only a few months later, in December of 1985, Rae Dawn starred in a movie called The Color Purple. The other tarot card in the Golden Dawn system, the Star, whose note is still B-flat and color is purple, features imagery of a beautiful woman kneeling beneath seven small stars and one large star in the sky above. The seven stars in the sky resonate with the children's song from The Sound of Music, which goes through the seven notes of the musical scale, Do, Re, Mi, Fa, Sol, La, Ti, and brings us back to Do. The final Do of this scale is the same note as the first, but at a higher octave. This concept of the higher octave is symbolized by the eighth star in the image, the one large star positioned at the center of the seven small stars. The seven notes theme brings us back to Mick Jagger, a rock star whose career was defined by the role as the frontman of the Rolling Stones. When a sound remains in a fixed position, we call the sound a tone and we give the tone a name, a musical note. The description of sound as both tones and notes, anagrams of the word stone, signifies the same particle wave riddle that has puzzled quantum theorists for decades. What we call a musical note appears to be singular, but is actually a sound wave, a tone, which never actually remains fixed except in our perception of it as such. In a similar way, the alchemical allegory of the philosopher's stone alludes to a mysterious sacred phenomena called the water stone of the wise, the proverbial rolling stone, a waveform that remains fixed in a single identity if we choose to perceive it that way. In summation, Mick Jagger of the Rolling Stones appears as a musical rock star in his Just Another Night video with Rae Dawn, whose appearance that same year in the movie The Color Purple resonates with the Golden Dawn's tone color attribution of the color purple to the tarot card The Wheel of Fortune, which we find on the TV screen next to Mick Jagger in his promotional poster. The song itself is in the key of B-flat minor, which is the musical tone that corresponds to purple and the tarot cards The Wheel of Fortune and the stars themselves indicating the seven-tone scale and the higher octave from which Rae Dawn, the second note, is derived. For the record, Mick Jagger publicly denies any association with Kabbalah, and there's virtually no evidence tying him directly to the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. So how we interpret the emergent symbolic web is kind of irrelevant, or at least secondary, to the awareness of the web itself. Performance artists can be made to resonate with an archetype and, whether intentionally or not, seem to extend an acausal influence through their field by degrees of separation, bending the fabric of our collective mythos to include numerous personal and transpersonal iterations of their core symbol. As synchronicity sleuths, we follow the career of these artists and map out a unique composite character from their separate roles. We ask, what if the revelations of synchromysticism are not merely perceptual distortions of an eager interpreter, but instead a direct perception of something that has an actual existence? Are we witnessing the symptoms of a nuts and bolts conspiracy by the symbolic sorcerers who shape our media? And, if that were the case, could it be that the whole field of pop media nevertheless has a mind of its own, through which it weaves symbolic motifs, even as the performance artists and producers remained oblivious to the grand design of this invisible architect? Regardless of whether there's a conspiratorial element to these studies, another question inevitably emerges. What does it all mean? And as Ray Don Chong said, is it okay not to know?
Thanks, Ezra. For more about the Tone Color Alchemy System, please visit tonecoloralchemy.com. Andras here, and I just wanted to clear one thing up. The Stones Tattoo You actually came out in 1981, not 1980, as I mistakenly said in the Radio 8 Ball segment with Ray Don Chong. I should remember the date, as I was the victim of what was for me a pretty vicious middle school prank around the Stones tour that year. I was in seventh grade, and I was just getting into the Stones, probably a little too vocally for Washington Middle School circa the Reagan years, and I must have caught someone's attention because one afternoon in September of 81, I got a call from KISW, the local rock station. I was in my kitchen on Governor Stevens on the border of Tumwater and Olympia after school, and they offered me tickets to the Stones concert at the Kingdome in Seattle if I could just tell them the name of the Stones' new album. And of course, I knew it was Tattoo You, so I got it right. And the next day at school, boy, did I brag about it. Well, of course, as I said, it was a prank, so I didn't win anything. Well, that's not true. I gained perspective. So, I hope that clears up the mistake about the album release dates. Tattoo You did not come out in 1980, but actually in 1981. And if you want to see my making that mistake as some kind of revealing sink, well, so be it.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Synchronize. If you enjoyed this program, visit thesyncbook.com, where you can find archives of all the Syncbook radio shows, subscribe on iTunes, donate to keep the shows going, and find links to all our guests' websites. We also have two other weekly shows, 42 Minutes, which airs every Tuesday, and Always Record, which airs every Thursday. At thesyncbook.com, you can find both of these podcasts, as well as links to purchase copies of the Syncbooks. If you get your Syncbooks from Amazon, be sure to leave a review there. Amazon reviews help people find our work and helps get the word out. Please share these episodes with your friends and like the Syncbook on Facebook. Thanks again to all our contributors and guests, and thanks to all the listeners.
so hard to find. We'll be right back.